Welcome to another episode of Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you need help understanding your animal's behavior, we want to hear from you. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls today, we'll also discuss another topic. And what is it this time, Patricia?
We're going to examine whether dog owners tend to choose dog breeds based on who wins the Westminster Dog Show and what we should keep in mind each time a specific breed becomes popular.
And it's a really cute dog that won this year.
Does that date me or what? In 2008, it was a very cute dog.
And if you happen to be an animal lover who's also drawn to TV shows like CSI, perhaps it's time to put these interests together and help your dog become a dog detective. Later in the show, we'll meet someone who's trained her own dog detective and discover whether our dogs have what it takes to find missing pets. But first, let's take some calls at 1-800-462-7413. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Jen from Anchorage, Alaska.
Jen, thanks a lot for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 3.5-year-old English Labrador named Hank. We call him Hank the Tank. And Hank is a very, very vocal dog, and not vocal in the barks at everything he sees. He's pretty actually quiet in that respect. But he, upon meeting people or seeing people that he knows, especially if he knows people, he will start almost screaming.
Oh, dear.
And he kind of sounds like Chewbacca from Star Wars. I would say sounds exactly like Chewbacca.
Oh,
actually.
No kidding.
And, I mean, it is. It's funny. It's adorable. And the more people laugh while he's doing it,
yeah,
the louder he does it.
Yeah. And it's probably not too funny after a while, after the 200th time you've heard it.
Exactly. And then there's some people who... my father-in-law has a hearing aid, and so his little... I think it's so loud that it's kind of piercing.
Ooh.
And so I feel bad for situations like that. Or, you know, my dog comes to work with me, and if I'm at work and someone he knows walks in and I'm on the phone, he just, you know, he starts it, and it stops soon. And it's a lot worse if he has a toy in his mouth.
It's
He'll
worse.
Grab a toy.
Oh, that was going to be my solution. It's worse if he has a toy in his mouth.
Oh, yeah.
No kidding.
It's louder, and it's like he's even more excited.
Oh, so much for that great idea. Well, here's what I suggest. Give this a try for a while. Try this for about probably 6 weeks. And if you don't see some progress, it's not going to be all fixed after 4 to 6 weeks, but if you don't see some progress, call back.
Okay.
I need plan B. One thing I would do is whenever company comes to the door, rather than letting him greet them at the door, I would actually, this would be one of the dogs I would teach when the doorbell rings or somebody knocks, I want you to start a training paradigm where you run to a back room with him. You've got a great toy in your hand. You put him in a crate or just in the room, and then you shut the door. And you give him some food. Give him a toy that's stuffed with food. You're going to do this when there's nobody there at first. You're going to pretend. You're going to, like, ring the doorbell yourself, or you're going to open the door and say, hi. You know, we have that visitor voice. Hi. Dogs know that voice instantly, and you can fool every single one of them. You open the door, and you go, hi, and they'll be like, who is it? There's nobody there, and they're wagging, and, you know, your dog's yelling like Chewbacca. So you open the door and say, oh, let's go to your room. And then you run to the other room like it's a great fun game. Oh, this is so fun. And then you give him a reason to be happy for just 5 seconds in that room.
Okay.
And then you do that like 5 times in a row. And then you make it 10 seconds. And then you have a family member ring the doorbell. And then after a couple of weeks, you have other people ring the bell. So that's going to help you when people come to the house. Now, it's trickier when people come into your office and you're on the phone, for example. I would work on a cutoff signal or a chill kind of signal and do it out of context again. So basically, you're going to teach your dog to just calm down. So get him excited during play. Maybe you're playing a tug game or something like that. Get him excited. And then you stop. You sort of go still and go, chill. Or, quiet. And then, good boy. And then you can play again. So it doesn't mean that the fun's over. So I would work on teaching him a calm down signal and then start using it when you need it at work.
Mm-hmm. And good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jen. Thanks very much for calling.
You know, lots of us need a calm down signal, don't you think, Mueller?
Yeah.
It's just... Chill.
Chill, Larry.
Calm down. Well, you're pretty calm. I don't know about you.
Well, for the most part, I'm pretty calm. I get more agitated when we don't hear from people at that phone number, 1-800-462-7413. But thankfully, I'm calm again because somebody's there online.
Phew.
Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Aaron from Bedford, Texas.
Aaron, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, this is actually a follow-up call to a call that my wife placed several weeks ago about our cat Brown Bear. She's got a crying problem, and she's also got a waking us up in the middle of the night problem.
Okay.
And we tried some of the things that you guys had suggested, such as behavioral modifications. We've tried to ignore her, essentially, when she starts crying, and then also rewarding her when she's not crying, with treats and, but you know, giving her more attention when she's being quiet and just sitting there. And we've also tried the Feel Away plug-in.
Okay.
And that had absolutely no effect at all.
No help,
and,
huh? Oh, wow.
No, and we tried we tried some herbal anxiety treatment that a vet gave to us, but unfortunately we couldn't, crushing it up was the only way we could really give it to her because the pills were so large and she didn't really like that in her food. So
yeah,
just getting to be so much now with her crying just incessantly, and it's just, you know, we're starting to look for new homes now because we just can't deal with it. So
yeah, this sounds really tough. Let me give you a couple more suggestions in hopes that they might help. One is to direct you, not to pass the problem on, but I really would love to see more medical workups done on this cat. And one suggestion about the anti-anxiety medication that you weren't able to give your cat, and believe me, I totally can empathize. How many jokes are there about trying to get a pill down a cat? You know,
yeah.
A lot of them. And the reason they're funny is because they're so apt. But there are businesses that will do what are called formularies. They will take the chemicals that are in the active ingredients of the medication, and they will put them into usually a little liquid that you can add to cat food that tastes like tuna or chicken.
Mm.
So your veterinarian actually contacts these businesses. It's like a pharmaceutical company, and they create this additive that you could add onto the food that tastes like your cat's favorite food, whether it's tuna or chicken or something like that. And I actually use it very successfully when I had a very, very sick cat. So there are a lot of cats. You crush those pills up, and they're so bitter, some of them. They just don't taste well. So one, talk to your – don't give up on that idea. And I would talk to your veterinarian about two possibilities. One is anxiety, and the other is pain. Pain is very, very hard to diagnose. It's extremely hard to diagnose. So one thing that you just might want to ask your veterinarian, what if we try giving her a pain reliever and just seeing?
See what happens.
See what happens. Come back to us again in maybe, 2 months. But I would definitely pursue those two types of potentials with your veterinarian.
Yeah. Good luck, Aaron.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patricia, Carol from Laurel, Maryland sent us an email to ask you this question. And here's what it is. One of my cats likes to eat his moist cat food with his left paw. Now, at first this looks cute, but it turns out to be a big mess. What he doesn't lick off his paw, he flicks off.
Oh, no.
Food goes onto the floor, into the water bowl, and onto the wall. And just after one meal, the feeding area is a mess. Is there any way I can discourage this behavior?
Oh, yuck. Boy, I really sympathize. I can just see that. Can't you just see this cat flicking this stinky, yucky, fish-smelling food all over the room? Yes, that's a great, it's an evocative image, I should say, not a great image. I'll tell you what I would do. This is not brilliant. This is not like neuroscience here, but I would just deal with this logistically. I would give the cat a combination of a really high-quality kibble along with plenty of fresh water, and I would give the cat cut-up meat and give it to your cat because you can't, a little
can't
piece of chicken, you can't smear your paw around it and flick it around. I just do it logistically. Larry, you have any brilliant ideas to add on to that?
My brilliant idea is to use your brilliant idea.
Well, that's our sum total. But you know, I think this might actually be an easy fix. They don't have to have canned food. Try real food.
Somebody else might have a suggestion too. They could email us.
That'd be a great idea. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org. We would love, if you had a similar problem, maybe it was a right pawed cat. You know, there's research on handedness in dogs that shows more dogs are left-handed rather than right. Maybe more cats are left pawed than they are right pawed. Maybe this is the beginning of a research project.
It could well be. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, does best in show mean best in home? Discover whether certain dog breeds become more popular after winning the Westminster Dog Show. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McCottle, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and it's that time of year again when the winner of the Westminster Dog Show is announced. Patricia, does a win at America's most prestigious dog show result in more people having the winning breed as a pet?
Well, you know, it's a really good question because I've heard a lot of conversations about, for example, acquiring beagles as pets after a very cute beagle named Uno won Westminster in 2008. But Larry, all of these conversations assumed as a fact that a win at Westminster would increase the popularity of the breed. And now in this case, in the case of Uno and the beagle, there were some people who were very worried about that because they felt that beagles, oh, they're not the greatest pet. They love to bark a lot, as Uno showed
on the
Westminster show. They love to dig. They love to run. They follow their noses. You know, you can't call them to come when they're running in their woods. Other people were thrilled because a lot of people believe that beagles are really great pets.
Is there any factual basis for this assumption that breeds become more popular after a win at Westminster?
Well, you know, I started wondering about that. So I went back and looked. I looked at the statistics from Westminster wins and American Kennel Club breed registrations, which is a relatively good way of tracking how popular a particular breed is. And you know, the evidence for a Westminster effect, it was not overwhelming if it was there at all. I looked at, for example, I looked at the 2005 win, which was a German short hair pointer. Now, if you looked at their ranking in the registrations before that, in the late 1990s, for example, it was ranked 24th. In 2005, the year it won, so there couldn't have been an effect yet, right?
Right.
It ranked 22nd.
Sure.
So if you look 2 years after a German short hair won Westminster, you would expect to see this big
jump.
Rise, yeah, if there was an effect. But, you know, there was only a minor increase. It wasn't that big of an increase. It climbed, if you can say that, to 19th in 06 and to 18th in 07. So, you know, is that significant? I'm not so sure.
No.
You know, maybe a little tiny bit of a bump, but not really a very impressive one. And that's what I saw generally when I looked at all the breeds. Now, beagles are already ranked number 5 in popularity, and they've been like 4 or 5 for years and years and years. So it doesn't have very far to go. So I'm not sure we're going to be able to see a bump from the beagles.
You know, we also hear that the popular movies like 101 Dalmatians, I guess, is an example, can have a big effect on breed popularity. Is that based on fact?
That is. If you look, there are indeed significant changes. Dalmatians, for example, it is indeed true. It's not an urban legend, is that Dalmatians were more popular after the release of 101 Dalmatians. Border Collies after Babe. Rough-coated Collies moved to number 3 on the registration list after Lassie came out in 43. Now it's number 38, by the way.
Okay, so what should we keep in mind each time a new breed makes it into the limelight?
You know, it's really simple. Just do the same way that you would advise your daughter and your son to date. Don't make your decisions based on a pretty face or a compelling story. Do the research and make sure the breed you're interested in is the right breed for you.
And speaking of pretty faces or handsome faces, maybe, how about we see who's pretty or handsome face is waiting to talk to us next at 1-800-462-7413. And by golly, we have somebody online. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Laura from Annapolis.
Annapolis, Maryland. Laura, thank you very much for calling. And what can we do for you?
Well, I have a question. I have two cats who are elderly. One is 15 and the other 17. And I just adopted two twin toddler girls who are making my cats miserable. But one of my cats is a pretty good with them. He actually hangs around with them, and he lets them chase them, and we've taught them how to be gentle. Pet them gentle.
Yeah.
And so he's okay. But I worry more about my other cat, Samantha, who is a little scaredy cat. She's always been kind of afraid of everything. And so now she stays all the time upstairs in the bedroom where they can't get to her.
Mm.
I was wondering if there was a way to get her less afraid of them and get her to be able to be in the same room with them.
It's a tough one, isn't it? I really sympathize because these fraidy cats, you know, there's a reason that phrase is so popular. Cats, mm-hmm. almost like cats are digital, you know. I don't hear about many of them that are like sort of okay, you know, around
yeah.
kids. They're either like, hi, yo, you, pet me, and they're like rubby, rubby, rubby. Uh-huh. Or they're, oh, no, something's different. Something moved. Something made a sound. I'm going to run and hide.
Yeah, that's
And her. We know there's a very strong genetic basis to this, by the way. Very, very strong. And if you integrate that with a particular type of environment in early development, if you take one of these genetically shy cats
mm-hmm.
and for the first, even 4 weeks of their life between week 4 and 8, so really early, before a person would tend to get a kitten,
mm-hmm.
they haven't had a lot of social interaction and environmental change and stimuli,
mm-hmm.
you get a kind of a double whammy where you can get a cat who is quite fearful about particularly little toddlers. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. Toddlers can be pretty scary things.
Oh, they are. They run scream. And
yeah.
They
you know, I mean, I've been scared of a toddler.
You know? Me too, recently, a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you've considered hiding under your own bed, right? So
I consider getting in the crib. So
one of the things to keep in mind, the first thing I want to say is your cat has actually developed a perfectly reasonable strategy.
Oh,
if the cat
okay.
was not getting any time with you, I would worry. I would worry a lot. There's certain things you can do in terms of the environment. You can try that plug-in pheromone called Feel-Away.
She has those.
You've tried that, obviously. That's probably not the solution based on the way you're talking.
Yeah.
I would let her do what she's doing as the children get older. Uh-huh. They will get better at inhibiting their own emotional yeah. excitement. But right now, I would basically let her choose the strategy she's chosen. It's not a bad one at all.
All right. Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call very much. You can join us as well at 1-800-462-7413. And we have another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi.
Who are we speaking with?
This is Miriam from Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Miriam from Fayetteville, Arkansas. Thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome.
What's on your mind?
Well, we live in a 3-dog household, and we have 2 elderly bachelor whippets, 13 and 12 and a half years, and an interloper dachshund named Oscar.
What a match.
Yes. Well, the interloper is causing kind of some curiosity around the household. He has a graduate school-aged master or daughter who likes to dress him in clothes occasionally. And he does not object at all when she puts on the clothing, but the moment that he has on something like a little coat, he immediately changes his personality. He gets extremely quiet, extremely subdued. He's even walked into the hall and put his nose in the crack where the wall and the floor meet and just sat there for 5 minutes without moving.
I think this is called objecting.
You think that's what that is?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
within
5 or 10 minutes, he's just up in his old self, clothes and all, but at the beginning, he's very odd.
You know, what? There are many ways to react to something that makes you nervous or uncomfortable. And one is to get all sort of very active and flighty. You know, people talk about the fight and flight response, you know, fight versus flight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are more Fs in there. There's also freeze, which is very, very common. At the extreme, it's called tonic immobility. I don't know if you have ever been so scared or any of our listeners have been so scared they literally couldn't move, called tonic immobility. And actually, sometimes animals look relaxed. There was a great research project done by UC Davis looking at sheep when they were being shorn. And they're up on their little hind ends and they're sitting like little puppies and they look, their heads are slumped over. They really look relaxed. If you look at their cortisol levels, they're actually extremely stressed. They're in what's called, it only lasts, you know, it only lasts. I mean, I'm stressed when I go to the doctor. So, you know, I have my sheep shorn and I'm like, I'm sorry, guys, but it'll be over in 5 minutes, you know.
Right.
And so it's not cool, but nonetheless, animals can freeze when they're nervous or scared. And what your dachshund is saying is, I am so uncomfortable. Now, after 5 minutes, it sounds like he gets used to it. I would suggest, though, that the pleasure in this is definitely not on the canine side.
Not surprising.
You might want to rethink this. I have known animals who actually seem to enjoy getting dressed up. I really have.
Love it. They ask for coats when they're chilly.
Well, I appreciate your call very much. I'm a kind of a flight guy myself. I'm not one of these fight guys.
Yeah.
Something scares me, man, I'm out of here.
I don't know.
If
Larry needed to step up to the plate, I...
Well, if I had to do that, but if I didn't...
You'd protect me, right, Mueller?
I would.
So you had another question.
Yes, should I suggest to my daughter that she not put clothing on him, or should we... What shall we do?
Well, I'll give you a very personal opinion. It's very personal. You know, we all make our own choices here. But since your whippets like it, and I would suggest the dachshund doesn't, I think an extended wardrobe for the whippets would be a fine idea.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call very, very much. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. And you can also email us, as a matter of fact. And Patricia, we heard from Jennifer in La Crosse, Wisconsin, emailed us. She recently adopted a dog from a rescue shelter. Her dog appears to be a chocolate-colored border collie, but her tail is docked. People tell Jennifer that her dog must be an Australian Shepherd because of her tail. Jennifer found photos of border collies and Australian Shepherds online, and she saw photos of each breed that resembled her dog. So she wants to know, are there any distinguishing features between the breeds that would help her know which one her dog actually is? Does a docked tail absolutely mean she's an Aussie?
No.
Probably not.
It does not. And in answer to your question, is there a distinguishing feature that can guarantee to tell the difference? Yes. It's DNA.
That's about it.
And even that's going to be a little dodgy because there's been, especially in this country, there's been a certain amount of crossing. You know, when I did my PhD research, I spent a summer in Montana on sheep ranches, and a lot of them use border collie Aussie crosses. You don't see a naturally docked tail in border collies. I've at least never seen that. But people dock tails. You know, it happens. Mm-hmm. And sometimes dogs have accidents, or on rare occasions, sometimes dogs are actually born with sort of a naturally docked tail. That's not very common. But
so both people could be right, or both sides could be right. It could be both a border collie and an Australian Shepherd.
It actually is possible. I will tell you that because these breeds for so many years were bred for behavior, it's a great study, actually, Larry, in genetics of what does an individual look like if you start breeding for behavior? You get a lot of cross overlap. So it's very possible you have an Aussie. It's possible you have a border collie that's 3 standard deviations outside of the bell curve. So I'm not answering your question at all. The answer is yes, maybe no.
All right. Well, you could have just said that right away and been done with it.
I could say that's all. That's it. That's my answer to everything. The show will go really fast, Larry.
Well, I'll tell you what, to get that answer, yes, no, or maybe, maybe you want to know if it's maybe, yes or no, you can call us at 1-800-462-7413. And, of course, you can also email us at...
Oh, we love to get your emails. Send them to pets@wpr.org.
Coming up next, find out how your dog can help lost animals reunite with their families. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and today we welcome Kat Albrecht to the program. Kat is a former police bloodhound handler and is author of the book Dog Detectives, Train Your Dog to Find Lost Pets. Kat, welcome to the program. What inspired you to begin training dogs to find other animals?
Well, you know, it happened by accident. Back in 1996, my police bloodhound escaped from my yard and was lost in the woods. And I was the typical panic pet owner needing to find my lost dog. And I, because I was involved in search and rescue and training dogs to track people, I called another search and rescue dog that I had helped to train to find people. And we scented her on AJ's bedding, and she tracked him down in 20 minutes and found him. And that's when I realized, you know what? I know how to train dogs to find people. Why aren't we training them to track lost pets? So that's when the journey began.
And what a great need there is out there. It's just so terrifying when your cat or your dog is lost. I would love to hear about some of the stories you've had and some of the searches you've been on.
You know, it's been an amazing educational journey, because as I began looking for missing pets, and again, it wasn't until 1997 that I fully committed myself to trying this as an experiment. I took my retired cadaver dog, Rachel, my Weimaraner, and just as an experiment, wanted to see if I could have her find missing pets. And in her first four searches, she found two missing cats and one missing dog. You know, and I realized, okay, I'm on to something. And the pet owners were grateful. One of her first finds was for a cat that was injured, and the owner saw it run under a neighbor's deck. But when they looked under the deck, they couldn't find the cat, and they assumed that it had left the area. So I scented Rachel on that cat's brush, and she took me straight to that deck and turned around and jumped on me, which was her human decomposition alert that she had found human remains. And she took me back to a different area of the deck, pawed at it, and we crawled under there and looked, and there we found the cat, and it was no longer alive. But it brought closure to that family, and she went on to find many other cats that were not alive, some that were alive. And just helped me through a journey of learning how to apply techniques that already exist in search and rescue to find missing people and apply them to missing pets, and we found many.
What types of dogs are best suited to be dog detectives?
You know, it varies. We really don't look at breed. We look at the drive and the temperament of the dog. We want a dog that is has no major fear issues, absolutely no aggression towards humans, dogs, or cats. A dog that is willing to work in inclement weather, whether it's warm weather or cold weather, and a dog that either has an excessive interest in playing with other dogs, or a dog that loves kitties and will give a physical, excited response when they smell the scent of a cat. And so we want a dog that will get the kitty but not get the kitty.
There are different ways to get the kitty.
Yeah, and there's a fine line there, and we discuss that in the book on how to determine that your dog is suitable. for the job.
So I would guess that there are a lot of dogs out there who, frankly, this is a pretty narrow job description. So I would guess there are a lot of dogs out there who probably aren't suitable for this job.
Exactly.
What are the traits that would eliminate a dog as a good job candidate?
A dog that has had too much obedience training and will not leave its owner's side. In other words, if it's had a lot of healing work or is continually looking at the owner for direction, is probably not going to do well with the trailing training, because we want a dog that when it sees another dog run away and hide around the corner, we want to see the dog almost going crazy with excitement and straining to get away from his owner and forging when the owner releases the collar and will be attached with a leash to their dog but runs with their dog. We want to see their dog dragging them to get to the other dog, because the basis of this training is hide and seek games, and we teach the dogs to really forge ahead and use their noses to follow the scent of the other dog. And a dog that is afraid of cats or aggressive towards cats would not pass.
Yeah, that would probably be a
a deal breaker.
Probably a deal breaker. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, my stereotype of a dog would be one with his nose to the ground and trailing after the scent, the old bloodhound story. But there are that's a technique, but there are other techniques that you talk about as well. I think you have three techniques. Would you describe those for us?
Sure. There's three basic categories: the cat detection dog, the MAR, and we're using the term MAR, missing animal response, to define what it is we're doing. It's very similar to SAR, search and rescue, so we just crossed over to call it MAR. Mm-hmm. So there's the MAR cat detection dog, the MAR trailing dog, and the MAR dual purpose dog. The MAR cat detection is a dog that loves kitties, and the way we evaluate the dog is we put a cat in a Sherpa bag that looks like a suitcase. It's black and mesh, and the dogs typically never realize there's a cat in there. And we walk the dog up to the bag, and when we see a dog that's excited and it's wagging its tail, whining and wiggly about a kitty being there, that dog is taken and trained to detect the scent of a cat, used in an area search mode, going yard to yard to yard, looking for a missing cat under and in everything. The MAR trailing dog is a dog that loves to play with other dogs. It goes crazy when another dog runs away and hides. And that dog is trained through an extensive 36-step training process that can take 18 months to track the scent of a lost dog. And the MAR dual purpose is a dog that tests well for both. It's both a dog that goes crazy with other dogs and wants to play with them and loves kitties and gives a response. And so that dog can be trained to track dogs and detect cats.
You write about decomposition training. What is decomposition training, and how important is it that we teach our dogs to do it?
Nearly all search and rescue dogs that are trained to find missing people are trained in decomposition. I think now that the term they use is human remains detection. And with the MAR dogs, it's the same. Many times when we're looking for a missing dog, a cat, a ferret, a parrot, we need the dog to understand that even if you smell, detect the odor of an animal that is not alive, we need for you to let us know that. And so we do teach the dogs, we cross-train them on decomposition of cats and dogs and other animals. We can obtain these materials from our local animal control or from veterinarians. But it is very important in that I've had a case before where I've been tracking along and came across skid marks and a stain in the roadway. And we need the dog to be able to tell us, is that an oil stain or is that a blood stain? We also use presumptive blood analysis test kits that we teach the pet detectives to use in order to make a determination and potentially do a DNA test as well.
Your book helps us be a little bit of a pet detective as well by talking about differences in behavior, somewhat predictable differences in behavior between dogs and cats. Would you talk a little bit first about what cats tend to do when they go missing?
When I first started this work 10 years ago, I was trained in the differences of how humans behave, that a backpacker, a berry picker, and a hunter can all be lost in the same area of woods, but they travel different distances. They behave differently when lost, and the techniques used to find them are entirely different. And so I began to see that the way a cat behaves is much different than a dog, and the way that a displaced cat, like an indoor-only kitty that pushes out a window and escapes outside, that's an entirely different scenario than an outdoor access cat that suddenly vanishes. In a nutshell, cats, indoor-only cats, when they are displaced and escape outside, they hide in silence as a protective measure from predators. So they typically look for the first place to hide, and they remain silent there. And you can use a baited humane trap as a recovery tool to get that cat back home. Outdoor access cats, when they vanish, it means something has happened to interrupt their behavior of coming home. They might be trapped. They could be injured, could have been transported out of the area. There's eight different scenarios of what can typically happen to a cat, but you need to get into your neighbor's yards looking under and in everything.
And what about dogs?
You know, there are different dogs travel, and they're picked up by people that often determine what happens to them. Many times people who find the dogs assume because of the location where the dog was picked up in a rural area, they assume the dog was dumped. Or they find a dog with a skittish, fearful behavior, which can be the result of genetics, and, you know, it can be their DNA that predisposes them to be skittish and fearful, but yet the finder assumes this dog was abused, and therefore they're not even going to call the number that's on the tag. So we encourage people to think lost, not stray. When you find a dog or find a cat, assume that there's a family that loves it, that's looking for it, and work aggressively to try to find that family before you make assumptions about the dog. But, you know, they're harder to find than cats. They both have their challenges.
You know, one of the things I found interesting in your book when you were talking about the MAR, or missing animal response training, one of the bullet points you have in the book is how to detect deception when interviewing people. And I found that kind of interesting. How would we need to know that, or why would we need to know that?
Because we have had cases where when we're interviewing neighbors or family members where the story is just not matching up with what happened to the pet. For example, one of the pet detectives had a case where the boyfriend was telling, was making a claim that he had let the cat outside accidentally. And yet the evidence, both a witness that came forward and the work that the dog did and where the cat was ultimately found, totally conflicted with what he said. And so it was speculated, and by his body language, the pet detective said, you know, I could tell that he was not telling the truth. You know, and as a detective, you know, through the interrogation and interview training that I had, in neurolinguistics, in being able to tell when somebody is being deceptive, it really helped in being able to pass that on to pet detectives. In this particular case, they realized the boyfriend had taken the cat and dumped it elsewhere.
Let's say my cat disappears this afternoon and I don't find the kitty and I don't have a trained dog. How do I get a hold of somebody with your kind of training cat?
Yeah, that's where you would go to the website, pethunters.com, and there's a section, Find a Pet Detective. And we have a national directory of pet detectives that anywhere from someone maybe in your area who can come out with a dog and help you search for your cat. You may, if you don't have a pet detective in your area, you may consider hiring somebody who's going to have to travel a distance, but just understand that the fee might be rather steep for doing that because we don't have enough people trained up yet. That's one of the purposes and missions of our organization. It's a nonprofit organization called Missing Pet Partnership. We want to see community-based lost pet services. We need dogs and people trained up in all communities for this. So you can find the limited resources on our website, but we also have lost pet recovery tips that can help you as well.
Great.
Kat, a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Kat Albrecht is the author of Dog Detectives, Train Your Dog to Find Lost Pets. She joined us today from the studios of KVPR in Fresno, California. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Kat's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And now it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and five winners will be selected at random to win a copy of Dog Detectives by Kat Albrecht. And here's today's question. In her book, Kat talks about how dogs have an incredible sense of smell, nearly one-eighth of the dog's brain, and over 50% of the internal components of the dog's nose are devoted to processing smell. Now, inside the nasal cavity and opening into the upper part of the mouth is something called the Jacobson's organ. The Jacobson's organ is a sense of smell receptor that is actually not receptive to ordinary odors. Instead, the primary function of the Jacobson's organ is to detect what type of odorless chemical. If you think you know the answer, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. And to find out if you're correct, visit callingallpets.org and we'll have the correct answer posted online in about a week. And we'll take some calls right now at 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Peter calling from Roanoke. Thank you for taking my call. I have a 5-year-old female German Shepherd, and she's a great dog. The only issue or concern that we have is whenever we are driving in the car, she's totally fast when the car is at speed, but once we begin to slow the vehicle down, she gets very, very antsy and very irritated. So that's kind of a problem because once in a while we get stoplights or we have to stop or slow down for certain things on our trips.
So she doesn't like the slowing down.
Not at all.
What does she do when you slow down?
She kind of walks all over the back seat and kind of moans and complains. Kind of, she's really antsy. Irritated. So it's really kind of a problem because we have to, you know, say, hey, Ginger, calm down, Ginger. It's okay.
Yeah. And it probably doesn't help very much.
That's correct. She's actually what I call a little speed demon of a dog.
You know, sometimes when animals are able to sort of act out their anxieties or their fears or their irritation, frustration, it actually makes them worse. And sometimes, you know how policemen will say, everybody just sit down? You know, police officer, just everybody just sit down. She might actually benefit by being a little bit more confined, perhaps in a crate or with a doggy seatbelt. You can get harnesses that you attach to your seatbelt, and they're much safer, too. You know, if she's loose in your car, she really is at risk. If there's an accident, the most common thing that happens actually is not that dogs get injured in the accident. It's that when there's an accident, they get out of the car and get hit by another car or get lost. So just for safety purposes, it would be a good idea anyway. But I've found a lot of dogs, if you teach them to ride in a crate in the back of the car, or if you get them so they're sort of seated or lying down in the back seat and they can't walk around, they can't build up some of that energy. So that's not going to be a complete cure, I pretty well guarantee you. But that's probably going to help. My guess is that what she's learned is that slowing down means you're maybe going to get to where you're going. And oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, then I get to get out, I get to play, I get to see people I love, and then get her in a confined situation and try and find a way, maybe give her a toy stuff with food or something to keep her distracted.
That's a great suggestion.
And just to go along with that, Bobby in Vero Beach, Florida called us a while back to tell us how she helped her dog cope with traveling in the car. She says she keeps her dog in a crate, and one thing she's done over the years is to make sure the crate has a level surface. So if you put a crate in a lot of cars, it slants and the animal becomes frantic because it can't get stable and doesn't feel secure. So Bobby says she always carried a couple of extra beach towels in the car so that the crate was nice and stable on the seat. And she always made sure she had a soft little towel that she could put inside the crate for her little dachshund, and it really worked great.
It's a great idea. And I have been, over the years, I have learned how important footing is for dogs. And, you know, even when they're sitting in the back seat, they're not designed to fit in a passenger seat. They have horrible footing in a passenger seat, especially the more molded it is, the harder it is for them to get good footing. So creating a stable, flat surface is such an important idea. It's a great pet tip. It's a very important aspect of having your dog be comfortable. I have a crate in the back of my car, and my guy, Jim, built me a little piece of wood frame kind of thing.
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't do this myself. Obviously, he had to build it for me, right? But yeah, but it makes my crate be completely stable and flat on the bottom, and it's really important. So great pet tip. Thank you so much for that.
And Peter, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it, and hopefully we'll be able to have some really cool travel to Denver.
I hope so. All paws are crossed.
All paws are crossed. And I'm crossing my paws that we get some more of those pet tips.
Oh, we love to hear from you. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to join us by phone, the number is 1-800-462-7413. And let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Camille.
And Camille, where are you calling from?
From Piercy, Northern California.
Northern California. Okay, well, what is on your mind?
Okay. Well, we have a three-year-old dachshund, a standard called Elliot. We got him a few years ago at a rescue home for dachshunds. He follows my husband everywhere. He loves my husband. And he follows him into the bathroom, and he chews up the toilet paper.
Into the toilet paper.
And last night he chewed on the down comforter. I made a hole in it. So how can I stop him from doing these things? And yeah.
Well, you know, chewing is such an interesting thing because it's, you know, just what dogs do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Dogs play, you know, Larry and I are sitting here playing with our paper clips, you know, because humans like to use their fingers, you know, when you're not doing anything, you're thinking and you're talking and you look down at your hands and they're usually moving.
Right.
Well, dogs' mouths are it's the equivalent in a dog, you know. They can't play with little fingers on their paws, so they play with their mouths.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the tricks, as we all know, is to teach them to do that appropriately and not inappropriately. It's a huge problem with a lot of us. Thinking about the toilet paper, there are several things you can do. One is you can just shut the doors to the bathroom. Sometimes just simplistic logistical answers are the best one. You shut the door to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Why he started chewing on the, what concerns me a little bit about why is this happening now? You know, if he didn't chew before, did he ever chew before, or is this completely out of the blue?
He's always chewed some, but you know, I have several toys for him and all that. But, yeah, this is maybe 3 months or 4 months.
But he's always chewed some, you said. So,
yes.
So,
but not on the toilet paper, more on other things. But then I've, you know, kind of trained him to chew on his toys.
You know, it's so easy for some behavior to get reinforced. And as soon as it's reinforced once, it's like, oh, there's been toilet paper all these years, and I didn't know, you know? It's like I started bird watching when I was in my 30s. I was like, I've been surrounded by birds for 30 years, and I never noticed how amazing they are, you know? And then I became an inveterate bird watcher. So bad habits are the same way. You discover this is fun. Well, you know, look at what I've been missing.
Mm-hmm.
So don't worry about so much, unless you get a dog who's doing something that makes you think maybe he's anxious. But my guess is, chewing on toilet paper is like, well, this is a fun game to do. And dogs may like their oils in there, you know, their petroleum products in there. And so that might be something that tastes good to them. And I would go buy some new toys. You know, when we talk about our dogs have a lot of toys, remember they're the same toys. Dogs evolved to live in a varied environment.
Mm-hmm.
And to find new bones and new sticks and new things to play with. So you might want to pick up all your toys. Buy some new ones. Put three new toys down. Maybe you want to use a little food inside. Maybe have some hollow ones that keep the dog chewing on that. Give the dog lots of things to chew on. Some dogs don't like to chew on hard things. Some dogs like to sort of chew up little soft things. That's fine. Buy some, you know, cheap dog toys. Just be careful because sometimes if they ingest pieces of them, that can be dangerous, obviously.
Yes.
But so do a little table of your dog's chewing preferences. Then buy appropriate toys and keep them fresh. You know, keep 15
rotate.
Of them up on the shelf and rotate.
Okay.
So give that a try.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Camille, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. 1-800-462-7413, our number. And here's another caller. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Elizabeth in Highland, Maryland.
Elizabeth, thank you very much for calling. What's up with you?
I was having a discussion with a friend of mine who does feral cat rescue about cats and birds. And I said, do you bell any of your cats? Are you concerned that they're catching birds? And she said she has never seen any research supporting the idea that pet cats are particularly dangerous to birds, and she hasn't seen that herself. And I was curious, is there any research that's been done to actually support the wives' tale that cats are having a significant impact on bird populations?
Oh, yeah.
There is. There's actually quite a bit of research. Exactly how many birds is extremely controversial, but there is quite a bit of research that makes it very clear that domestic cats can have a significant impact on bird populations. Some of that work was actually done here in Madison by Stanley Temple, the Department of Ecology at UW-Madison. There's also work that has been done in Great Britain about pet cats and what kind of prey animals they brought back. There's been some that's been done in Australia. So actually, this is a topic that's gotten quite a bit of attention. And again, exactly what percentage of birds that are dying because of pet cats is quite controversial. But there's no question. I don't think there's anybody out there who doesn't agree that there are millions and millions and millions of pet cats out there. And there's some farms that have 15 cats, and that those cats can have a significant effect on the population of songbirds. So this is not just an urban legend.
Okay.
All right. So you can pass that on. Dr. Stanley Temple from the Department of Wildlife Ecology, UW-Madison. You could put that in a search engine and find that research.
I will. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Patricia, thank you. You had some great suggestions this week, as always. Appreciate it very much.
Well, I hope they helped everybody out. We'll find out soon enough, I suppose.
We will. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. And Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0315P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.
On the next Calling All Pets, join us to discover why prairie dogs have a vocabulary all their own.
And we'll also welcome a children's author who shares her how-to guide for introducing kids to dogs.
We hope you'll join us for that and more of your calls on the next Calling All Pets.